Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Just ask. But that simple prompt is easier said than done. Asking can save you money in the long run. Whether it's asking for a raise or asking for a discount on the new car you want, there are effective ways to negotiate if you make requests. Matt Schultz is a personal finance author, educator, and speaker. He's going to talk to us about his book, Ask Questions, Save Money, Make More. Then, discussing money with other people is hard as it is. Discussing your salary, ugh, gross. Canadian millennial money expert Jessica Morehouse is going to talk to us about the importance of salary transparency and how to push for these tough conversations in your own life and career. And if you're nearing retirement, sometimes the expenses can really, really add up and you're not sure how you're going to be able to balance that with your home and all that. A reverse mortgage could be an option for you. And there is a relatively few players in Canada. One we haven't talked about is called Bloom. And we're going to talk to Bloom's founder and CEO, Ben McKay, on how their product works. Plus, I'll speak with Carly Kalish from Victim Services Toronto about a program called Reclaim. It helps survivors of human trafficking reclaim their name after being burdened with debt. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. You may have heard the quote, ask and you shall receive. I looked it up. It's from the Bible. It is not necessarily how things play out when you are asking your boss for a raise, trying to get a lower mortgage rate or a better deal on the car you want to buy. But part of the challenge might be in the way you start these conversations. Matt Schultz is a personal finance author, educator, speaker, and he wrote a book called Ask Questions, Save Money, Make More. He's got a bunch of different scenarios that help you save money just by making requests. We reached him in Austin, Texas. Hello there.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This is a different take. I mean, there's thousands of personal finance books out there. This is a different take. And I want to begin with the headline at the very top of your introduction, which reads, "You have more power over your money than you realize." What do you mean by that?
I mean that oftentimes people feel helpless and powerless when it comes to their money, especially if they're dealing with giant banks or huge companies or really even friends and family sometimes. But the truth is that you do have more power over your money than you realize. And part of why that is that when you're talking about businesses, whether it's, you know, a small mom and pop place or a giant bank, most businesses view you in terms of lifetime value, meaning the longer you stick around, the more money they make off of you. So knowing that, businesses are often willing to waive that $40 late fee or to give you that logo t-shirt or things like that to keep you happy because they know that that little bit of money that they give you is going to engender such goodwill that you're going to stick around and they'll make more money off of you in the long run. Once you understand that, then you're coming at this from a position of power rather than you feeling like you're groveling or things like that.
We're going to get into some of the specifics, but one of the things you have chosen to do in writing this book is to provide people with actual scripts like if X, then Y, which is super helpful. Can you give us a bit of an example for what a request would actually sound like?
Yes. The request that really inspired the book is about asking for a lower interest rate on a credit card. And about 3 out of every 4 people who ask for one of those get one, but far too few.
Where did you get that data point from? That is a shocking data point.
Isn't it? It's why I wrote the book. In my job at LendingTree as chief industry analyst and in previous jobs, kind of looking over and analyzing the credit card space, we have at LendingTree We have done that survey, and I've seen it done in other places as well. But yeah, this year it was 76% of people who asked for a lower interest rate on their credit card in the past year got one, and the average reduction was 6 percentage points. So that's like going from 25% on your card to 19. It's really significant stuff.
So you pick up the phone, you call the credit card company. What falls out of your mouth?
Well, the first thing you do before you pick up the phone is you do a little bit of legwork, whether you're looking at sites like LendingTree or NerdWallet or Bankrate, or in your snail mail, or at your bank that you have a credit card or checking account, a checking account or savings account with, and seeing what offers are out there that you would qualify for. And when you have one that you know that you qualify for, then you can use that to frame the conversation. So you can pick up the phone and say, "Hi, I've had your card. I love it. I've always been a good customer, but my interest rate on it is 27%, and I've just been offered this card at 21%. Would you be willing to match it?" And because the credit card marketplace is so competitive, they're at a minimum going to listen to you, and there's a decent chance that they'll work with you.
It's funny because, as you put it in those terms, I think, well, we tell people to do that with their cell phone all the time and their,
Yeah.
internet service provider all the time. We don't tell them to do that on credit cards and for credit card interest rates in particular. You recommend people ask open-ended questions. So the example that you gave, which I love, is don't say, "Can I get a lower price on this car repair?" Do say, "How can we lower the price?" What's the difference between those two approaches?
The difference is that a closed-end question makes it really is basically a yes or no answer. And what you're wanting to do in these negotiations, in these conversations, is to not give the person on the other end of the phone or across the checkout counter an easy out. So if you ask an open-ended question where it's, "Can you lower my interest rate?" as opposed to, "Who on your team can I speak with about getting my interest rate lowered?" Just that little change can make it to where it's a conversation instead of an ask. And it's a little thing, but it can be really significant.
You're a big believer in following through because I look at those scripts and you're like, "No, then I'm doing this. No, then I'm doing that. No, then I'm doing that." How far do you take this? Would you go like park in the driveway of the CEO of Capital One?
Well, it's really ultimately the biggest thing that you can do most likely is threaten to close that card and take your business elsewhere. It's important that if you are going to do that you understand the ramifications of it, particularly to your credit score. But if you are willing to potentially close that card and leave and take your business elsewhere, that is how you are most likely to get them to work with you. It's really the same concept as going to a car dealer and saying, "No, I think I'm good." And then you walk out the door and the salesman chases after you and says, "No,
Right.
I have one more deal." It's really the same concept. These folks don't want to let you leave because your business is valuable to
And
them.
we for sure don't want people closing down credit cards because of the credit score impact, but you can threaten it and then just not use the card. You can use a different card for your transactions without canceling it. You preach the power of phone calls. Are you 90 years old? Who picks up anymore?
Not gonna lie, sometimes I feel like it,
Yeah. Why is voice to voice better?
voice to voice or face to face is better because, again, it's people are less likely to say no if you have developed a sort of rapport with them. And it's really, I mean, we just look at social media as the perfect example, and we see all the time. I mean, platforms are built basically on this idea where people say things to people in social media and in text that they would never in a million years say to them in a Zoom or in a phone call or certainly face to face. So yes, it's certainly a little old fashioned. And yes, I do also understand that it can be difficult just to get a person on the phone in some cases. But generally speaking, if you can actually speak with another person, your chances of getting your way are far better than if you're going through a bot or something that's emotionless and never really makes that connection.
You have three categories that you apply to help you assess the ask: possible impact, chance of success, and simplicity. How do you recommend people use those categories?
Well, it really is kind of about figuring out how, whether you want to go about doing it. And what I really wanted to do with really the whole book, but especially with those three concepts, is to just kind of anticipate people's concerns and people's questions about whether this will work. And it's the idea of, you know, if I do this, is it going to work? And if I do want to do this, how hard is it going to be? And if I do end up going through with it, how much does it really matter? And those are all really significant things, because if something is going to take you forever to do and you're not really going to gain anything from it, then it's not really worth the effort. So the idea of those three things were to help people kind of gauge the likelihood of things working and kind of the amount of effort needed to do those things.
Some of our listeners will be like, sign me up, love it, let's do it. It's in my comfort zone. Now I've got a new access to ways that I can do that. But I would bet the majority of people who hear this conversation will have some sort of barrier, some sort of hurdle. It could be time, it could be self-confidence.
Yep.
How do you address the yeah buts for people who are like, I can't do that?
Well, the biggest yeah but is really that people are scared of negotiation. People don't want to negotiate, even sometimes that in a situation where they know that they're going to be successful. And one of the big points I want to make from the book is that you have way more experience with negotiating than you realize. And it may sound kind of strange, but most everybody has negotiated what the temperature is going to be at their house with a partner or a roommate. People have negotiated who in the carpool is going to take their kids to soccer practice on what day, or when that meeting is going to be at work, or where you're going to go to dinner with a group of friends. Even though those are a little bit lower stakes than medical bills and job negotiations, it's still the same concept. And if you can feel comfortable in those sorts of things and apply some of the same concepts to those bigger deal things that you do to the smaller everyday things, then it can really help.
Just before we go here, practice. What is the purpose of practice and how do you do it? Am I like talking to my spouse, pretending that they're the credit card call center person?
Potentially, yeah. If you feel like your spouse is the right person to do it, maybe it's a relative or a colleague or a friend, but really what it is about kind of preparing you to play the game, I guess is kind of a way to look at it. So you run through one time where everything goes perfectly and it just couldn't have been easier. Then you run through it another time where it maybe gets a little tougher, they give you a little more pushback. And then maybe that third time, the person you're role-playing with just hammers you and you kind of see what some of your answers might be. And sure, you're not going to be able to predict exactly what the scenario is going to be. But in the same way that Steph Curry still takes 500 shots a day, even though he knows that he may not take the exact same shot in the game, it's really about getting those reps, feeling more comfortable, and being ready when it comes time for you to do your thing.
Okay, I'm sneaking in one last question. What is your number one don't? Anger, tears, or something else? What's the don't?
Anger is a pretty big one. Tears can be okay if they are not manipulative and if they come from a genuine place. But really, being a jerk is about the biggest no, because the truth is that person on the other end of the phone or across the counter has probably been yelled at 10 or 12 times already today. So you can really stand out by being nice. And we all get consumed with wanting to be an alpha and tough guy and all that sort of thing. So much of life is really just about being nice and treating people well. And then you'll be amazed at exactly how much you can get accomplished then.
Basically playing into the strength of Canadians from coast to coast to coast. That's who we are.
There you go.
Nice of you to join us. Thank you for accepting our request, and best of luck with the book. We appreciate you making the time.
Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Matt Schultz is a personal finance author, educator, and speaker. His book is called Ask Questions, Save Money, Make More. Coming up next on Moolala, if you are over the age of 55 and you own your own home, you might want to be thinking about ways to unlock that equity. There's a reverse mortgage. You've heard about that product on this show in the past. There is also a prepaid MasterCard that can help you access some of that equity. Ben McCabe is the CEO of a company called Bloom. It's a fintech. We're going to talk about that card and reverse mortgages in general. Later, talking about your salary with others can be very, very uncomfortable, sometimes not wise, but salary transparency is a really big idea. Jessica Morehouse will be our guest to talk about why it is important and how to underscore that and seek that in your own career. If you want the latest and greatest Moolala has to offer, you can keep on top of it by signing up for our newsletter. So it is a once a month thing. It just links to a bunch of conversations we have had on this show, segments we have done for CityLine and CBC and all that kind of stuff. To sign up for that newsletter, go to moolala.ca.
Hi, it's me, your dad. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Life is really expensive these days. I don't need to tell anyone how the cost of living has risen across absolutely all parts of our life. And that's a real, it's a burden for lots of people. It's a burden for homeowners in particular who are living in a place that they love, but they have a hard time finding the cash to put groceries in their fridge, to pay for maintenance and all that. A lot of people are house rich these days, but that doesn't manifest in terms of their experience of being able to live the life they want. And one of the solutions that's been around for a couple of decades is called a reverse mortgage. There's a couple of players offering that, not a ton, but a couple. We're going to talk about a relatively new player called Bloom. Canadian company, fintech. Joining us is the CEO, Ben McCabe. He joins us from Quebec City. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. It's great to be with you.
So reverse mortgages, I think we should start with the definition, because those who are in this circumstance, they probably know lots about them because they see this as a real leg up, a real opportunity. But in terms of the mass audience in Canada, not a lot of people know what a reverse mortgage is. So you can start with the definition.
Yeah, absolutely. So a reverse mortgage is similar to a regular mortgage. It's a loan secured against a home. The main difference between a reverse mortgage and a regular mortgage, there are two of them. One is that it's only available to Canadians that are 55 years of age and older. And the second difference is that it doesn't require any payments. So like every other mortgage, you either need to, you know, if it's a HELOC, you need to be paying your interest. If it's a regular mortgage, you need to be paying interest and principal. With reverse mortgage, you don't need to pay any monthly bill. The interest will get added to the balance, and then you don't need to pay it back until you pass away or until you choose to sell your home at some point in the future.
And with a traditional mortgage, you're buying or borrowing a chunk of money. With a reverse mortgage, this could play out in terms of like a, you know, like a monthly $3,000 check. How does the cash come into your account?
So that's a, it's a very interesting question. There are reverse mortgage type structures that work like that with a, you know, sort of the function more like an annuity, but that's actually a minority of reverse mortgages, certainly in Canada. I'd say the vast majority of reverse mortgages are actually structured as a lump sum. But I think what's an important thing to understand is that it's rare that a lump sum is actually just dropped into a client's bank account. Usually what reverse mortgages are used for are to address some type of large use of proceeds. And what that use of proceeds is in 80% of cases is refinancing an existing mortgage. So if I'll just give you an example. So, you know, a client, let's say 71 years old named Diane, she owns your average value home in Canada, $700,000. And she retired a couple of years ago and she wasn't able to fully pay off her mortgage. So let's say there's like $200,000 of mortgage against that house. Now, she was able to service that mortgage before she retired while she had her employment income. But now that she's living on her retirement income, that $1,500 that she's sending to the bank every month out of, let's say, $3,500 of, you know, average Canadian retirement income, that's just not suitable. It's not sustainable. It's not going to work for her. So she needs to get rid of that mortgage payment. So that's often what the reverse mortgage is used for, is to eliminate that mortgage payment.
For those who aren't carrying a mortgage, they're just living in a home that they love, how do they unlock some of the equity to put the metaphorical groceries in the fridge?
Yeah, so that is, you know, you can use a traditional lump sum reverse mortgage for that if you want. You know, alternatively, you can take out a reverse mortgage, only take some of it up front and you come back for another chunk later. You know, there's different structures that are available like that. And then we at Bloom, we've just introduced a new product to address exactly that situation, which is somebody who just wants a little bit every month to kind of supplement their purchasing power, which there's, you know, statistics would show that many Canadians are in that situation. We just introduced our Bloom Home Equity Prepaid MasterCard, which is a tool that allows people to unlock their equity in very small increments, really just whatever they need at the register.
I love that idea and I hate that idea in equal measure, because, and I say the hate, I say partly tongue in cheek, because we often as personal finance folks say, don't use your house as an ATM, which is effectively, it sounds like what that card is doing. So play out the two sides of this. For whom is that card really a valuable resource, and for whom is it dangerous?
Yeah. So there's a lot to unpack there. So let me start on who can be useful for. And I think to answer that question, I think we need to kind of look at the data. So we just conducted an Angus Reid survey where we surveyed, you know, many 55 plus Canadian homeowners. The results are staggering. 67% of Canadian homeowners don't believe they have enough income or savings to sustain their quality of life through their full retirement. In the context of the rising cost of living in Canada, 46% of Canadian seniors are actively thinking about going back and taking part-time work to be able to make ends meet. So the percentage of Canadians who could benefit from a slight income supplement in retirement is really, really large. Now, I think it's a very, very good point that you make, is that you don't want to be using your home equity irresponsibly. And if you don't have a large use of proceeds, like let's say, for example, you know, exhausting an existing mortgage, making some accessibility renovations to your home or giving your kids a living inheritance, you do not need $300,000 dropped in your bank account starting to accrue interest with the, you know, on a traditional lump sum reverse mortgage. You just need a little bit. You just need what you need to bridge between the income that you have and the income that you would need to have to sustain your lifestyle that you got used to before retirement. Maybe that's $500 a month. Maybe that's $1,000 a month. Maybe that's $2,000 a month. But what we do with the card is we establish a sustainable and responsible monthly spending limit. Oftentimes that sort of caps at around $2,000 a month. And because we establish that spending limit, it really is used as just an income supplement, just to give somebody a little bit extra to live that quality of life that they dreamed about living in retirement. It's not extravagant. It's just enough to get by. And in the cost, in the context of, you know, the fact that a basket of groceries has gone up 20% over the last 2 years, there's a lot of people that can benefit from a solution like that.
How would you articulate in the simplest terms possible what the interest rate is that one is charged for a reverse mortgage proper or for the card, as distinct from what they would be paying if they were able to have a traditional mortgage at a primary lender?
Yeah. So let's take the other end of the spectrum, right, which is a credit card. And that's what this is not. This is not a credit card.
Yep.
Credit card, 20% interest. You really should be servicing that. You should be paying that bill every month. Otherwise, that's going to get out of control. The Bloom prepaid MasterCard, we charged exactly what we would charge on a regular reverse mortgage, which is somewhere in sort of the high 6% range. So, you know, much closer to a traditional mortgage, you know, interest rate. And then, you know, where does a reverse mortgage interest rate sit relative to a traditional mortgage interest rate? Probably maybe 100 basis points, sorry, like 1% higher, you know, just where you think about where rates are today. So there's a slight premium that people pay because all the features that reverse mortgage have, right? Like, no, you know, no need to make payments, no fixed maturity date. You don't need to pay us back until you're ready or until you pass away. So a slight premium there, but, you know, certainly, you know, far, far away from what people would be paying on a credit card.
One of the knocks, there are two principal knocks on reverse mortgages. One is the cost. A second is a concern around masking a cash flow issue that a reverse mortgage will ameliorate for a period of time, but not forever. How do you have the conversation with clients to kind of check themselves to say, like, how sustainable is this plan? Would it be better for you in the long run to downsize to a cheaper place to live, such that you've got some cash left over for assisted care if you do indeed live to 90 years old?
Yeah. Yeah. So I hesitate to go into too much math here, but I think that I just want to double click on this idea that it's not necessarily a sustainable solution. Let's just, I just want to give a quick example. Okay. Average home price in Canada is around $700,000, right? The average home price, the rate of home price growth over the last 30, 40 years in Canada is around 6%, right? So $700,000 times a 6% annual home price growth, that's going to add $42,000 of home value every year. Now, let's just say it's somewhere less. Let's say that 6% rate is something a little bit lower. Let's say it's 3% or 4%. It's still adding in, you know, let's say high 20%, you know, value to the home over time. So it really depends on how much you're borrowing, in terms of you know, whether or not the growing mortgage balance would actually accelerate past the rate at which your home price is growing. So in many, many cases, this can actually be a sustainable solution. And in the past, if you look at just the historical data, the concept that that the mortgage balance, you know, will grow and eventually, you know, take up a really significant portion of the equity of the home, that just doesn't always play out in reality because of the benefit of home price growth. So I think that that's a very important thing to keep in mind.
I mentioned off the top, there are very few providers, Home Equity Bank, Equitable, your Bloom, your FinTech. How would you differentiate your view? What has you be different from those two other players who are more entrenched?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think you can go online and see our reviews in terms of like the reviews that customers give us in terms of, you know, why and how they've enjoyed their experience with us. But really, you know, we're not a bank. We're the only sort of non-bank provider of reverse mortgages in the country, although the product that we provide is basically identical in terms of all the benefits and features and rates and things like that as the other providers. And I think the one thing that we can really do that some of the other providers can't is, you know, we're not burdened by legacy technology and legacy platforms. You know, we're able to create, and we have created a system for helping people unlock their equity that is the most elegant and the most streamlined and most comfortable for our clients. And that's not to say that we want our clients to move too quickly through this process, right? Because this in many cases is going to be one of the last significant financial decisions that a lot of our clients make in their lives. And it's very important that they take all the time they need with their families, with their advisors to ensure that this is the right solution for them. But you know, what we want to be able to ensure is that it's not them waiting for us in terms of going through the process. So I think that's sort of, you know, one of the primary things that we've really leaned into as a fintech provider. And then, you know, I think with our, you know, Bloom prepaid MasterCard product, you know, we're pretty confident this is the first of its kind in the world, really, which is a card that clients don't need to pay a monthly bill on, really, potentially for the rest of their lives. And so I think we really obviously lead with product innovation.
What's the maximum limit on that prepaid card? How much trouble could someone get into if they fell off the rails?
So what we try to do is we look at, you know, the total amount of equity that we could theoretically unlock for them. And then we break that down into smaller chunks in terms of a monthly spending limit. Because what we want to do is ensure that the product is available to them for, let's say, at least 10 years. That's sort of like, because in 10 years time, they'll be older, so we can probably unlock more equity because that factors into the equation. Their house is probably worth more, so that it can be revisited at that time. There's no guarantee that it will last that long, but that's what we try to do in terms of establishing that spending limit. So, you know, in the past, we've authorized spending limits anywhere between $500 and $4,000.
Very interesting stuff. Ben, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
Ben McCabe, CEO of Bloom. We were talking about reverse mortgages, but in particular, this idea of a prepaid MasterCard that will allow you to draw on that home equity in smaller increments. Coming up later, we'll talk about salary transparency. Our guest, Canadian millennial money expert, Jessica Morehouse. But first, survivors of human trafficking are quite often burdened with debt through no fault of their own. We'll talk to Carly Kalish from Victim Services Toronto about a program they call Reclaim. A note for you in terms of how you spend your week, Wednesday afternoons. If you want to listen to some news you can use on personal finance, I'm the money columnist for CBC Radio. So what that means is I appear on the afternoon drive programs on CBC shows from coast to coast to coast, and even on cbc.ca/listen. So tune in for a little bit of moolala over there too. Moolala Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. Victims of human trafficking are affected, impacted in many, many different ways. Not only have they gone through a traumatic experience, they may often end up with a brutal legacy of debt. Victim Services Toronto provides trauma-informed support and advocacy for those people affected by human trafficking. And they have a program called Reclaim, which is designed to help survivors who may have been impacted financially. Carly Kalish is the executive director at Victim Services Toronto, and she joins us now to tell us how it works. Hello there.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It is our pleasure. I think one of the important ideas that we need to set up off the top is what you mean when you use the phrase human trafficking. What does that mean?
So in a Canadian context, human trafficking is force, fraud, and coercion facilitated by a third party to a person. So what that means in layman's language is that when someone is being forced, coerced, exploited, manipulated, and we're talking about sex trafficking specifically today, into the sex trade. So someone is benefiting from your exploitation in the sex trade. That's what we're talking about.
And it isn't just people who are coming from outside our borders who think they're coming to be a nanny and then they arrive and someone steals their passport. It could be someone who has spent their entire life in Canada who has fallen into really horrendous circumstances.
Yes. So of course, international human trafficking exists, but we focus at Victim Services Toronto on domestic human trafficking. So people who are from Canada and being trafficked within Canada. You can actually be from Toronto and be trafficked in Toronto. No movement is necessary for human trafficking to exist. And in fact, over 70% of the human trafficking that exists in Canada is domestic in nature, which is a total misconception.
I did not know that. There it is, corrected in a moment. Make the connection here between victims of human trafficking and money. What is the connection?
Yeah. So often we understand, and it took us a while to understand, but finally we understand the sexual exploitation that human trafficking survivors face. But no one is really talking about the financial exploitation that sex trafficking survivors face. And so traffickers are experts at learning as much as they can about you. And they're often people you know, not strangers. And they're finding out what is missing in your life and finding a way to fulfill it. So that's often in an intimate relationship, right? So 85% of the survivors we work with identify their trafficker or their pimp to be their boyfriend. And so these guys, and they're mostly guys, but of course they can also be women, are learning as much as they can about you. And they're often finding out what is missing in your life. So that might be financial, like a place to live, or, you know, we could start a family together, or you might want to go back to school. And so they're using what is missing in your life, and they're selling to you that through a relationship with them, they can help you fulfill it. And of course, their finance, you know, money is a part of that. And so you're making money, it's sold to you like you're making money together for your future, for your life. So that's one component. Mm-hmm. Now, through this trusting, often intimate relationship, two things happen. So you're either fraudulently tricked into sharing your identification, and often that's your credit card or a debit card. And sometimes you're coerced into providing details of your access to your financial information. So we're seeing both of these things. And what we're seeing is that traffickers are opening credit cards in their survivors' names. Sometimes they know and sometimes they don't know. They're putting car leases in the survivor's name. They're connecting highway toll accounts to the survivor's name. Sometimes they're opening up fraudulent student debt, again, in the survivor's name. And they're using this as a mechanism, of course, to not get caught, right? Like if, you know, the police find you and it becomes a he said, she said, for example. And then the credit card in which you booked all the hotels, in which you've booked all the Uber ad drives, in which you've booked all of the escort ads on Leo's list, mm-hmm. on a credit card that's connected to the survivor's name, it becomes incredibly hard to prove that somebody made you do this, right?
So here you are, you wake up and you have one or both of a massive credit card debt and a major hit to your credit score. Because I bet in some cases you don't even know that this debt has been accumulated. You're surprised that this has happened to you.
That's exactly what we're seeing. And so survivors who are at a place where we can support them in leaving their trafficking situation, or they've come to us once they have left, they start getting these calls from creditors and they're like, I have no idea what this is. I didn't open this credit card in this name. I don't have a car lease. What's going on here? And so it's impacting their ability to recover and move on and rebuild their lives. Mm. So it's not only a mechanism for traffickers not to get caught, but it's a mechanism to force people back into their exploitation.
So you have a program. You have used the experience that you have working with victims over the course of years to develop this program called Reclaim. How does it work?
So first of all, we have a peer expert advisory. So we have staff on our team and a whole advisory committee made of human trafficking survivors who this has impacted, who are consulting on every step of the program design and delivery. So that's very key to how we do our work. But what we do is that we work with creditors on behalf of survivors to advocate for the fraudulent and coercive debt that has been incurred because of their trafficking. And through our relationships, and we have really strong relationships with all the major financial institutions, with many major creditors, to advocate on behalf of these survivors by explaining the situation. And also we have financial experts on our team who are forensically looking at their credit reports, looking at their credit card history, comparing credit card statements to before they were trafficked to when they were trafficked. There's very marked changes. And using that evidence to advocate that this debt is in fact fraudulent or coercive and therefore should be removed. And I have to tell you that most creditors and all the major FIs are partners and very supportive in removing this. And so, and that's what we do. We've been quite successful in alleviating this debt so survivors can move on with their lives.
How long does this take? I mean, we work in credit counseling. We know how long these things can take. It's not easy. There's a whole bunch of other extenuating circumstances, often for the human at the center of it.
Yeah.
When you look at someone who enrolls in the Reclaim program, at what point are they at the other side?
I wish I had a straightforward answer, because some cases are completely simple and could take a few months. Like, we have to, wait for your credit report to come in. We have to go through that with the survivor. You know, the survivor has to be at a place of readiness, because of course, you know, we want to do our best to alleviate re-traumatization, but inevitably this is a, you know, a sharing of details of trauma, right? And so it could take a few months, and it could take, you know, sometimes up to a year, unfortunately. It depends on the nature of the creditors that we're dealing with, right? So some are incredibly helpful and understanding, and then some smaller players are, you know, stuck in holding on to whatever they can. And so, you know, we have to sometimes be quite creative in our advocacy. So I'm scared to say a timeline, but we'll do whatever we can, right? Yeah, exactly.
I referenced the phrase trauma-informed support off the top. Can you tell us a bit more about what that means and what that looks like? Because I can, anyone who's racked up any debt is dealing with some flavor of shame and self-loathing and all that. In this case, I can imagine the colors of those feelings and the magnitude of those feelings. Different, bigger, more nuanced, more complicated. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, it's of course incredibly layered, right? And it's not, we want to stop you from having to tell us every detail of your trafficking situation, right? Like, that's not necessary in order for us to advocate for you, right? We do need some sort of understanding in terms of the timeline, because we are not advocating for legitimate debt unless, for example, the legitimate debt incurred interest that was because of your trafficking situation, right? And so it's really, being trauma-informed is explaining what's happening every step of the way and giving choice, right? And giving the survivors options and choice. You can tell us this if you want to. This is not totally necessary for you to get into. Here are your options here, right? Like, it's giving people voice and choice. And you can imagine how layered it is for when you've gone through, like, literally hell and back. And then you think you're out, and then, you know, you're well enough that you want to get housing, and then you go to a landlord and he says, okay, give me a copy of your credit score. And then someone else doesn't, you know, you don't get picked, and someone else gets picked over you because your credit score is bad and it's not even your debt, right? So it's actually in it's, you know, this layered trauma that's impeding people from like literally being housed. And so you can also imagine how traumatic it is for, again, a regular person to get a call from a creditor saying, you owe us this much money. But for a human trafficking survivor, those calls are not just a reminder of the money you owe, but it's a reminder of the sexual trauma you've endured.
Carly, thank you for the conversation, and thank you for your work and you and your whole team. It really is inspiring to hear what you've accomplished with Reclaim.
Thank you for having us. It's a pleasure to chat with you today.
Carly Kalish is the Executive Director at Victim Services Toronto, and she was here to talk about human trafficking in the context of debt and what can be done if you or someone you know has found themselves in those circumstances. Coming up, the importance and the challenges of salary transparency here in Canada. Canadian millennial money expert Jessica Morehouse is here to talk about that. And listen, if you don't want to wait a whole week to listen to another episode, you can go listen to Moolala anytime you want. You can do that at the website, moolala.ca. You can do that on any of the podcast platforms. And there's two options. You can listen to a whole episode. Just put the whole episode on your device. Or you can listen to specific segments if you have an interest in a topic. Also, while you're there, subscribe. Just do it. Subscribe. And leave a review too. That'd be like a bonus.
Hi, it's me, your dad. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Money can be tough for people to talk about. We obviously on this show do not have a problem talking about money. We do it every single week. But for some people, it's really, really hard. And then focus the topic. Salary. That is really, really, plus really, really hard to the order of 20 for people. We're going to talk today about the importance of salary transparency. And our guest is Jessica Morehouse. She's a Canadian money expert. She is the host of the More Money podcast. Hello there.
Hi.
Why is salary transparency important in Canada in today's day and age?
I wish there was more transparency when I started my corporate career before I went self-employed, because I made so many mistakes and I left thousands and thousands of dollars on the table because I never knew what the salary range for any of the jobs that I had ahead of time. None of them posted them at the time. And I didn't think to talk to other people in similar industries, similar jobs to be like, hey, what should I ask for? There was no information. I think the only differences. There was one job I had, this one kind of second job I had, and it was union. And so there was a booklet. It had everyone's rate. So it was very clear. And it was great because there was no office politics in terms of, why that person's making more and they're really not very good at their job. Everyone, there was no conversations about money as much. It was a really nice experience. And so I always kind of thought, why aren't more companies adopting this? Mm-hmm. It will, you know, alleviate a lot of tension, and you could probably not only do a better job of recruiting the best talent, but keep people who feel like they're being undervalued, because maybe through the grapevine, they find out that they're actually making less than their counterparts.
So we can look at this question or challenge from the perspective of the individual, and we can look at it from the perspective of the organization. If we start from the organization, you mentioned mm-hmm. union jobs, you mentioned pay ranges. What are some of the things that would be considered best practices in terms mm-hmm. of salary transparency for organizations? What things should organizations be doing?
Yeah, well, I feel like usually the conversation around pay transparency is about recruiting new people. It's like, you know, post that on your job posting, because most I feel like I read a stat earlier today that was like 37% of jobs posted in Ontario are transparent with their salaries. The rest aren't. And that's not that many companies that are saying this is how much we're going to pay you. And still, they're not even really specifically saying this is how much. Here's a range. And the range could deviate by like $20,000. And obviously, you're like, I would like the top range, please. Not give that to you. But the other thing that when I was doing research for this, I didn't really consider is what the effects will be on current employees. If there's transparency on those job postings, then current employees will then be like, that's how much I should be paying. And then there needs to be discussions on how do we equalize that? Will those employees be like, fine, I'm going to go somewhere else and actually get paid, because hey, those jobs are telling me what I can get paid. Or do we have to do a lot of shifting? So it's one thing to say there should be more job transparency or a pay transparency. It is complicated in actually doing that to make sure that everyone is happy, because not everyone's going to be happy. If you were to find out, for example, when I was Googling this, I came up on an article and actually found myself quoted in it. I'm like, oh, I forgot about that. And I was sharing, I know, isn't that funny? And I was sharing my experience of working for a bunch of organizations. And it was only on the way out that I would ask my coworkers, how much do you make? Because there was just no, you know, there's no risk, you know, there's no jealousy to be had. I was on my way out. And every time I found out that I was making less than a lot of people. And I wish that I'd known this information before, but I wish that I didn't have to go about it on my own. I wish the onus was on the company a little bit more, because, you know, when it gets around in these backdoor conversations, it's just going to cause a lot of tension and just feelings of resentment. And usually it should be directed towards the company. And sometimes it's not, it's towards your coworkers.
Mm-hmm. So if we say that, and I think we are saying that there is a role for individuals to play here, it'd be mm-hmm. great if there was transparency at the organizational level. There's not, mm-hmm. maybe one day, but not today. How do you approach this? How do you mm-hmm. have this conversation with others in a way that is, socially acceptable?
Yeah. I found that it's very difficult to have those conversations with people within your company. Maybe if they're in a different department, so there's kind of no conflict and there's no way of like, well, I don't want you to find out how much I make because what if you're going to try to take my job? If you can have these conversations with people that are in similar roles, similar industries, so you can kind of do a side-by-side comparison, but again, there's no, I'm not coming for your job. I'm just trying to find out information. That's what I found very successful. And luckily now there are websites like Glassdoor and stuff that do have this information. Usually employees on their way out, then they post, this is my experience with the employer, this is how much I got paid. So that does help. One personal experience I've had is when I became, well, even before I became self-employed, I was, you know, doing kind of what I do now part-time. And I was talking to other, you know, content creators. And when we were talking to brands and doing negotiations, we would, you know, often talk about, hey, how much do you think I should charge? Or how much would you charge? Or I saw you did this similar campaign. What was the range? And you would think that there would be like some sense of competition. And again, some people maybe thought that as well. But I found that the rising tide raises all boats. If we all ask for more, then it's easier for the next person to ask more instead of shooting yourself in the foot, asking for less. And then the next time you work with that company or the next time some other content creator wants to work, then they are going to get less. So I found that was actually really great to have these conversations, but make sure you're not just asking how much did you make, how much did you charge, because some people are uncomfortable giving a specific number. Ask for a range, or even just say, if you were in this position, what do you think you would ask for?
Salary transparency lives inside of a context in our culture, and that context is that women make less than men. Yeah. When mm-hmm. we look at this in aggregate, it's just true. How do you weave that into your thinking about how women advocate for themselves and how senior women, senior mm-hmm. men yeah. can ensure that in the organizations they run, that there is equity on salaries?
Yeah. Well, I'd say from the organizational standpoint, that is where we need to make sure that there is somebody or a team of people that are involved with really looking at who is getting paid what and looking at some of those demographics. Because often like, oh, maybe it's just that they're, you know, less valuable employees. But there's actually a bias for a lot of hiring managers that they just think that women are less valuable workers, where if you were to look at the numbers, the output, all that kind of stuff, they aren't. And so we need to have some checks and balances in the hiring process so these biases don't run the show, which they still kind of do. The other thing that you mentioned is, you know, it is, unfortunately, the onus is sort of on the individual woman to have to negotiate. You see this all the time on social media, you know, influencers talking about, oh, you need to negotiate. And it is kind of frustrating because you're like, why does it have to be my issue that I have to, you know, I'm getting paid 83 cents on the dollar. Why do I have to fill that gap? Why can't it? It's actually a systemic issue. It's not my issue. And also, there's a ton of stories out there of a friend who, you know, brings up this research often on her own Instagram. Her name's Stephanie O'Connell, talking about the real stories of women negotiating, asking for more, and then getting the job offer rescinded. That is a thing that often happens. And so there is a real fear for women to, if I ask for more, are they going to take the job away and give it to this other woman who is maybe a, you know, equal candidate to me, who's not asking for more? So there's not really an easy, you know, answer to this. I think it is important to negotiate. That's one thing I look back on, wish I did more of. But the onus really shouldn't be on the individual. It should be on the system. And so I feel like the people within those systems need to be more vocal and need to make sure that there are ways of keeping things accountable. And especially if you're in a position of authority, this is really up to you. This is really your problem.
Yeah. So you mention that as a potential pitfall or a risk that you may advocate for yourself, and the hiring manager either thinks you're asking for too much or may infer from what is a simple negotiation something about your temperament that they feel is inconsistent with their culture that they might not say if you were a
dude. Of course not. But
we'll just put that to the side for 1 second. Mm-hmm. Are there any other risk factors or pitfalls that you would say, listen, we should just have our eyes wide open here as individuals? I'm not looking at it systemically here, but for individuals.
I mean, I think especially if you are a woman or marginalized in any way and you do fit, you know, you were earning less than a cis white man, basically, there the truth is there are certain industries that have more bias, that have more issues. And so it is really up to you. Do you want to fight the good fight and, you know, go up against this huge system that is going to take a long time to fix? Or do you want to work somewhere else where they're a little bit more equal, a little bit more open? It's a tricky situation. Just as an example, my last corporate job was at a law firm, the most old traditional industry in the world, very male dominated.
I smell the mahogany.
There was a lot of that. And I remember thinking, I was there for almost 3 years and I hadn't gotten a raise, and I, you know, created a completely different role than what I was hired and had a lot of results and output. And I just kind of realized I cannot fight this big beast, and this is too hard for me. So if I need to take care of myself and I want to, you know, grow in my career, I want to earn money, I can't do it here. And so sometimes it is about understanding that and leaving and going to a place that will help you grow. And sometimes that means a different company. Sometimes that means starting your own business.
Which is what you did.
Which is what I did.
And hooray for you. Sometimes those shoes are made for walking.
Yeah, they are.
Jessica, thank you for joining us. Appreciate
Thanks for having me.
Jessica Morehouse, Canadian money expert, host of the More Money podcast. She was here to talk about salary transparency, a topic we should, we're going to have to continue to talk about over and over and over, probably for a long period of time. All right, that's our show for today. A thanks to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. We'd love your thoughts. We'd love your feedback, your comments, your story ideas, all those things. To get in touch with us by email, ask@moolala.ca is the email address. ask@moolala.ca. To stay up to date on all things Moolala, you can subscribe to our newsletter at moolala.ca. You can subscribe to the show on whatever podcast you listen to. And if you are a social media aficionado, I am @BruceSellery on X. That's S-E-L-L-E-R-Y. Bruce Sellery Moolala on Facebook. Thank you for listening and have a great day.